This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. It is summer, and everyone is traveling, or at least has been traveling. Today's show is about a traveler's experience in Europe in 1937. It's a story about an Orthodox Jewish girl, Annabelle Drazen Rosenblum, who went to France and Italy on an art scholarship at a time when girls didn't travel alone, and at a time when Jews didn't survive well in France and Italy. Annabelle's story is told by her niece, Joy Passanante, who traced her aunt's steps through Europe and wrote an essay called Annabelle Before the War, Only What I See. Joy allowed Yin Radio to record a public reading of the story. The story covers 70 years, from 1937 to 2007, and it covers both Joy's travels and her aunt's travels 70 years earlier. Some of this story is fiction, Joy's imagined version of Aunt Annabelle's experience. Imagine Annabelle Drazen Rosenblum, a fresh young face fringed with bobbed curly dark hair, eyes alert, striking, and innocent. She looks out from an old yellowed image.
This is Annabelle, my Aunt Annabelle, who is married to my blood relation uncle, my mother's brother. But in our family, we don't make distinctions between those things after 50 or so years. So this is my wonderful aunt, and the essay is about her, basically about her trip to Europe in 1937. You can see that this is a newspaper. Her face, her picture was put in. It's in Hebrew. It's a Jewish newspaper that was in St. Louis, which had its own Jewish community from the immigrants who came at the end of the 19th and early 20th century. Her parents were among them. And the Jewish community was very proud of her because she won this art history scholarship that took her to Europe. And then I'll read you my essay and you can see what's going on there. Some parts of my essay are in italics, and I will say italics, but you will know when I say that, that what I really mean is I made it up. So I have several sections that are basically fictionalized based on the information that my aunt Annabelle, whom I also call Annie, by the way, gave me.
From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio with a tale of traveling. Joy Passanante reads her essay about her aunt Annabelle.
Annabelle Before the War, Only What I See. And it's dedicated to my aunt and uncle, Annie and Sammy. And Sammy just had his 95th birthday yesterday. And I had a lovely conversation with him. And he was very pleased that I was going to read this. So this is for him and Annie. At my daughter's wedding, as our guests assembled and the din crescendoed, someone announced directly into my ear, "Aunt Annie's here." I shifted my sangria to the hand of a friend and elbowed my way toward the entrance to the room. I knew I wouldn't be able to see her above the crowd. She was now, at nearly 93, permanently hunched over, and I knew she couldn't move easily toward me since her feet were so hammer-toed and bunioned. She needed help walking, and sometimes she had to shuffle. I knew, too, that when we met, she would not be able to hear me over the dense noise and music. Even when we chatted in the silence of her living room in St. Louis, or when I was talking to her at full volume over the phone, she could barely distinguish one word from another. But in that push to reach her soon, in the rush to wrap her in my arms, I also recognized that she was the most important person there. 2002. The St. Louis apartment in which Annabelle Drazen Rosenblum lives with her husband, my mother's older brother Sammy, faces Forest Park, a few blocks from Washington University, where she was a graduate student in art history close to three quarters of a century ago. The apartment is stuffed with the furniture she couldn't bear to abandon when she left the house they'd lived in for 40 years, and with her artwork. Her photographs and paintings are framed on walls. Her sculpture adorns shelves. She has sketched and painted her share of portraits and flowers and abstracts and still lifes, but the most arresting of her works are nudes. A clay-colored seated nude serves as a striking centerpiece for her dining table. A proud-looking nude of white plaster, hand on her hip, nearly grazes the ceiling, and I have promised to move the statue to my home in Idaho if and when Annie can no longer care for it, and to let it grace my garden. Among these naked women and intensely pigmented blooms, Annie sits opposite me and responds to my questions. I wonder if it isn't her art that connects me to her in more immediate ways than I connect to those family members who actually share my bloodline. In my urgency to rekindle her memory, I toss questions at her from several points of view, repeat myself, berate myself for not having asked these questions months ago, years ago, decades back. I am finally old enough to realize that what I feel about my own past is a terror that it will slip away unrecorded, unobserved, that it will disappear from earth and be absent from spirit without so much as a ceremony befitting the scattering of ashes from an urn. So I am grateful for this time in my 88-year-old aunt's living room, one more time. Annie and Sammy are holding hands. So that she can understand me, I have ratcheted up the decibels of my voice so much that it is cracking, but the racket from the window air conditioner has distracted me from my question. "What did you ask?" Annie says, and I shrug. Next to her, touching her, 90-year-old Sammy chimes in. "Annabelle's parents," he says, "were from two different towns in Russia, both of them in the Pale, the only place in that country that Jews were then allowed to live." His voice sounds ragged, but he finds a rhythm that carries him through. "Annabelle's father left Russia in 1904, he offers. Annabelle seems to remember, nods. "He had a friend who had known him as a young soldier," Sammy continues, "and the young soldier liked him. This friend was a representative of the Tsar." Sammy stumbles a bit over representative. He has had three strokes, so forming words sometimes takes concentration. "Well, he came around the village and warned him that he was soon to be conscripted into the Russian army to fight Japan. So Annabelle's father escaped. It took 7 years before he was able to get his wife and three children to America." Sammy smiles, happy to have been helpful. She pats his hand. Even into his 80s, Sammy tutored community college students in physics. Now he can understand only a little more clearly than Annabelle. He is legally blind, can no longer leave home without assistance, uses a walker to pull himself from room to room. My gaze is drawn to the space between his head and Annabelle's, to the sculpture on the dining table directly behind them, the bust of a woman. For the first time, I notice the expression in the face. Both innocent and irrepressible. Balanced on my lap is Annabelle's photo journal, depicting her own quest, her journey to France and Italy 65 years before. Her journal opens with this sentence, "In the depths of the Great Depression, I dreamed an impossible dream, a trip to Europe." In the summer of 1937, she had headed to a Europe on the cusp of war. In the past 2 days of questions and answers, I have learned that it took Annabelle 6 years to save enough pennies in her dresser drawer to embark on her voyage. She was elated when she found out that she was to be awarded a scholarship from Washington University. She was able to augment her savings with a bank loan, and her brother helped her make up the difference. And somehow, she bought a new camera, advertised at the time as revolutionary, an Argus Candid 4.5 lens with no light meter. And with no experience, she confesses, smiling impishly. She traveled by ship on the Holland-America line for 9 days. She had never heard, nor had anybody else she knew heard, of a woman who traveled unescorted by a man. Certainly not a 23-year-old Orthodox Jewish woman whose immigrant parents were only precariously settled in America. And certainly not after the Nazis' Nuremberg laws were in full force banning the Jews of Germany from all aspects of public life and designating Aryan areas from which Jews were excluded. In those days, Annabelle didn't talk about being Jewish. She hadn't said a word about it when she was a public school student in St. Louis, hadn't said a word about it when she studied and worked at Washington University. "I assume they knew I was Jewish," she tells me, "but we never talked about those things." You have to realize that back in 1937, people were not being Jewish. People were not comfortable about their Jewishness. If asked, I would not have denied it, but one was not asked. According to philosophers and theorists like Mordecai M. Kaplan, before the 19th century, all Jews regarded Judaism as a privilege. This is a quote. "Since then, most Jews have come to regard it as a burden. In the great flocking to America at the end of that century, it was more important to acculturate, to become American, and therefore to either cast off one's Jewishness or to be inconspicuous about it." So Annabelle never said a word about being Jewish when she was speeding to Europe on the ship, living in Paris, or touring Italy. At home, she was in the habit of accompanying her family to synagogue every Saturday. But in Paris, she went only one time, and alone. I asked why she attended services only once. She said, with a laugh, "I guess because I had other interesting things to do," which I thought was a good answer. She and Sammy, and I would conjecture the rest of my mother's family, chose silence. Once, while traveling in Wisconsin with friends, Annabelle squinted at a sign at the edge of a resort that read, "No Jews Allowed." And although Sammy can laugh at the ignorance now, he reports that a sign at a swimming pool near Missouri's Merrimack River read, "No Dogs or Jews Allowed." I leaf through Annabelle's fragile photo journal, a yellowing oblong with a plastic spiral binding, her loopy script annotating photos from pre-war France and Italy. The title reads, "Resurrection and Recollections" by Annabelle Rosenblum. The corners are cracking off, and I wonder if this might be the rough draft. There are scratch outs in both blue and black ink. Many of the black and whites in her book are ordinary views, with snaps of L'Arc de Triomphe, Les Champs-Élysées, Notre-Dame, young men in tight, long-sleeved t-shirts toting bicycles, women in wide-brimmed hats, but she captures character and does something extraordinary with light. Since I can get her to tell me so little about her feelings, I can resurrect them only through my own imagination. Here's the italics part. First one. As Annabelle steps gingerly down the gangplank of Le Havre, people are rushing by her, boats are blaring their foghorns. She doesn't know that in a few years this will be the most damaged port in Europe. The waterfront is gray, misted over, but the tiny dots of moisture on her cheeks refresh her. She has, after all, been on the sea for 9 days, and she has seen this view before, in the colorful canvases of the artists she has come across the ocean to study. Wasn't it the same view, the same air, that infused the muse of Monet when he painted that shimmering orangey sunrise over the bowl of the harbor, the painting that gave Impressionism its name? She hurries along. She must make her way to the train station to get to Paris, if she can, before dark. Get to the business of settling in, the business of immersing herself in art. When she arrives at the station in Paris, the first thing she sees is a sign on the wall with instructions on what to do in case of an air raid. It is between the wars. Something akin to fear stabs her in a place she can't identify. The next day she will suck in her breath at the bullet holes in the flanks of buildings. She will press her finger into one of these indentations, probe the jagged planes and smooth hollows the way she will probe the textures of clay and plaster when years and years from now she molds them into art. A handful of days after that, and she will try not to gawk at the guard who stands square-shouldered with only one arm at the Pantheon. Or the next day after that, at the guard at Les Invalides, who balances on his only remaining leg. We are lucky in America, she thinks. We don't see the suffering from war. I glance down at her journal and read aloud. Now, in 1937, another war appears imminent. Everyone talks about it. Could be any day. By the time Annabelle arrived in Paris in June, the Third Reich had already begun its assault on the continent. 5 months before she was cleared through customs in Europe, the Gestapo dissolved all Jewish youth organizations and warned other German citizens not to patronize Jewish doctors or lawyers. Nazi leader Hermann Göring ordered the establishment of a system to ensure that every Jew leave Germany. 2 months before Annabelle arrived, the Nazis revoked Jewish citizenship. Only 1 month before, German Jews were banned from receiving university degrees. Annabelle had already been in Europe for several weeks when the Nazis launched a notorious traveling so-called degenerate art exhibit of over 650 confiscated works of 112 artists, denouncing and deriding modern art, particularly by Jewish artists, as degenerate and Jewish Bolshevik. That same month, while Annabelle was studying some of the artists ridiculed in this exhibition and snapping pictures with her Argus along the Champs-Élysées, Hitler opened Buchenwald concentration camp only 250 miles away, and refugees from Germany, Austria, and Poland were already joining the 160,000 or so Jewish residents in Paris trying to resettle their families. Many of these immigrants were artists. As Annabelle strolled along the wide avenues and wound around the narrow cobblestone streets of Paris, did she recognize from time to time a sympathetic ethnic face? Some with features that looked so much like those of her Russian parents that glimpsing them made her pulse race? Did she nod to any of the other worshippers that Saturday morning as she murmured the Shema on a wooden seat on the women's side of the synagogue? Did she nod to anyone who would be murdered just a few years later? 3 years after Annabelle emptied her glass at the sidewalk cafe after visiting the catacombs below the streets of Paris, a photo of her with a group of friends records this moment. The French Vichy government issued the first Jewish statute. This law, as of October 3, 1940, excluded Jews from teaching, practicing law or medicine, and working in journalism, theater, or film. It also broadened the Nazis' definition of who was to be considered Jewish. The next day, all French prefects were authorized at their discretion to intern or force into labor any foreign Jew living in France. Within 7 months, the first major roundup of foreign Jews was executed. 2 months after that, with the overwhelming support of the French government and police force, 13,000 people, including over 4,000 children, were forced from their homes and held for 5 days without food, drink, or sufficient toilet facilities in the stiflingly hot, glass-ceilinged sports stadium, the Vélodrome d'Hiver. Then they were convoyed to a holding camp at Drancy, just northeast of Paris. From Drancy, they were systematically deported to death camps outside the country. By the end of the war, 80,000 Jews had been deported from France. Of the 13,000 non-French Jews deported from Paris in July alone, only 30 returned. Among the people deported would be more than 120 artists who had moved to Paris to work and exhibit within the rights and freedoms that were being stripped from them elsewhere in Europe. They had joined the convergence of painters and poets, critics and collectors, who flocked to the electrifying artist's life in Montparnasse, just a few blocks from the Halcyon Jardin de Luxembourg and the apartment where Annabelle lived.
You've been listening to Joy Passanante reading her essay, Annabelle Before the War, Only What I See. We'll be back with more of that essay after a break. If you're just joining us, this is Yin Radio with a show about a traveling woman, a young woman traveling alone in Europe long ago. In 1937, Annabelle Drazen Rosenblum left her home in St. Louis and went to France and Italy on an art scholarship. This was just as Nazi Germany began to overrun and control France, and to imprison and kill French Jews. The young Annabelle is Jewish. Annabelle's experience in Europe is captured by her niece, 70 years later. That niece, author Joy Passanante, traveled in her Aunt Annie's footsteps and tells her aunt's story in a combination of historical and fictionalized segments. When we left the reading a moment ago, Joy had been considering the crackdown on Jews and the roundup, deportation, imprisonment, and extermination of Jews that all began while her Aunt Annabelle was there, and what her young, Orthodox, Jewish aunt might have been thinking and feeling as this happened all around her.
2005. It is a crisp September day in Paris when my husband Gary and I, map and notepad in hand, stride away from the Palais de Luxembourg toward the heart of Montparnasse. We are on a mission to retrace Annabelle's steps to make real the places she recorded in her photo journal. We follow the column of trees just revealing the first hints of autumn and leading to the University of Paris, that imposing brick building with its band of bas-reliefs that houses the institute in which Annabelle took classes. I want to take the walk she would have taken from school to her pension. We find the Rue des Feuillantines, number 15, easily. We note Le Vin Sobre, which may well have been the cafe from where she's peering out at me decades later in her photo journal. I pose for a digital snapshot in Annabelle's doorway and again on a nearby corner where Annabelle took a picture of three friends. We spend some minutes comparing the backgrounds to make sure this is the exact corner. We argue a bit and finally notice that the far tall windows in the building in the background are indisputably the same. The boucherie is still there too, but now the buildings are hung with signs advertising lotto and something in Chinese. The tabac has become a bistro, and the boxy Model A-looking cars in Annabelle's photo have metamorphosed into Renaults and Citroëns. At the corner, we have to wait for an electric walk icon. We pass the hotel where Annabelle stayed while she was looking for a place to live. Formerly a la Villa des Artistes, it is now a Best Western. But the atelier, or studio, of Gauguin and Modigliani, which Annie was so excited to see from behind the little iron railing of her hotel room, is proudly marked. A little farther along the sidewalk is the place where she moved after a few days and which became her residence in Paris, across the street from the Painting and Sculpture Academy, number 14. I stretch my neck to glimpse the window on the 7th floor where she lived, and I'm relieved she didn't have to stay in what became the Best Western. I squeeze into the lobby and climb halfway up the steep red carpeted stairs before we turn around and swing open the door onto the narrow sidewalk. Suddenly, I feel a tug on my spirits. My shoulders literally sag. Perhaps it's that this walk, these streets, these buildings, even the tidy sign indicating the studio of Gauguin and Modigliani are really just superficial indications of the story I came for, the story behind the photos, the story that projects into the future of the photos and that has redefined them with time. It is near the end of the day, near the end of what suddenly feels like enough time in Paris spent following the steps of someone who couldn't give us many details other than pointing us in the generally right direction. The cobblestones have begun to feel sharp under our soles, and the air has a decidedly damp tinge. We are about to take the last metro to our hotel to rest up for our one splurge dinner in a famous restaurant when I notice a poster advertising an exhibit. It says, La première exposition des peintres et des sculpteurs de Montparnasse déportés, 1939 to 1945, the first exposition of Montparnasse artists, deported artists. My pulse surges when I read the date, my notions of what can be called contemporary, doing figure eights in my brain. If Annabelle was studying contemporary art, then certainly these artists must have been on her academic agenda. These artists, all of whom were victims of the Nazis. With a rush of energy, Gary and I walk the few blocks to the museum and enter a pebble-studded alley leading us to what was at the turn of the 20th century, the atelier of Russian painter Marie Vassiliev, who provided cheap food and drink to fledgling Montparnasse artists, including Leger, Picasso, and Modigliani. Passing by the Virginia creeper just reddening around the edges, we enter a quaint iron gate. We are about to round the first corner into the heart of the exhibit, and I hesitate. Small statues of female nudes, imbued with tenderness and grace, make me flash on Annabelle's sculptures. And I feel catapulted into another space, layers of the past spirited into a vortex wherein epics and minutiae, departed artists, Annabelle, and I whirl and jumble up and merge. These are small resurrections of memory, of connection, of art. They are the familiar in what I already know will be a surreal story, one that just should not, could not have been, a minuscule part of which I feel a rising urge to write. For the next 3 hours, we wind around walls of paintings and drawings, pedestals of sculpture, up a spiral staircase. As our eyes strain to take in every word of the neatly typed French text under each one, we slow our steps. I feel as if we are at a memorial service, reading the mementos, the tributes of the deceased. In the building, that afternoon, there are only a few people, two others, six, and we take our time. We have absorbed the spectacle of the Caen Memorial a few weeks ago in Normandy and stared solemnly at the exhibits in the Jewish Museum in Paris a few days ago. But somehow this exhibit, in its unassuming dwelling, makes my heart constrict. As we float from one beautiful or terrifying painting or drawing to another, each with its own chilling narrative, our heads swell with these stories. These artists' studios had been ransacked, their artwork shredded, smashed, and burned, or simply stolen. Several of them were murdered within hours after they arrived at Auschwitz. Many dared to continue to paint and draw from the camps and find ways to deliver their illustrations of atrocities to the outside world. Many of them kept working, continued recording, painted while hiding, sketched in Dachau on stolen paper, drew surreptitiously in a notebook in the Warsaw ghetto. One or two held secret exhibitions in the camps. One or two had fought for Germany in World War I. One was forced to copy masterpieces in a factory. Another was made to work on the construction of Auschwitz. Many were arrested at the border just as they were about to escape to Africa, America, Switzerland, Spain. One survived nine camps. One, who had opened an art gallery as a cover for the French resistance, was tortured daily by the infamous Klaus Barbie. Several committed suicide. Many of the artists in Montparnasse at the time Annabelle would have been studying them were immigrants. They had come from Russia, Poland, Hungary, Lithuania, the Ukraine, Siberia, Israel, and Germany. Like her parents, to flee repression. Like her, to partake of the dazzling artist's life of exhibitions and apprenticeship and animated dialogue and plying their art at Montparnasse. And like her, they came from humble origins. Their parents were grocers, tailors, slaughterhouse workers. Many found their way to L'École des Beaux-Arts. Many joined the French resistance. Some were founders of the Dada movement of expressionism. Many had connections with the artists who have defined modernism itself. Picasso, Klee, Man Ray, etc., etc. Had they been allowed to live, one can envision their names on gallery walls in Paris's Pompidou Center, or the New York's Museum of Modern Art, or London's Tate Modern. Even before they came to Paris, some had talked their way into art schools in segregated European communities. A few survived by hiding, by help, by luck. The only artist from this group of 123 whose work Annie can recall studying is Chaim Soutine. Soutine was born in a shettle not far from where Annabelle's parents were born. He volunteered to dig ditches for the French in World War I. I scour my memory for the well-known portrait that Modigliani painted of him, which he tacked to his art dealer's door, and which I had seen at New York City's Jewish Museum a year or so before Gary and I visited Paris. It depicts Soutine as carefree, eyes glittering with hope. At the Montparnasse exhibit, we spent a long time in front of what may have been the final photograph of him, tormented and wild-eyed. When the Second World War was declared, he was in a village in southern France where he had been painting poplars, and he was not permitted to leave. But when he became ill and needed surgery, his friends were determined to drive him to Paris. They took a circuitous route around Normandy to avoid arrest, and before the car reached the city, he died in intense pain. On a corner on our way back to the hotel, the Dome Café appears, its large gold script sign luring us toward it. I flash back to the photograph of a drawing by Henri Haeghe that was painted on a wall at Drancy, the sole trace of his artistic work. The drawing depicted three faces. The woman's expression is beatific, almost saintly in its resignation. The man's, round-eyed with awe. They both look up into a shower of light rays, but the face of a baby stares out at the viewer. It could well have served as an illustration from Dante's Paradiso, but for me, it recalls the Inferno. From there, Gary and I head straight back to our little terrace, arm in arm, not saying a word. Annabelle's decision to travel for a month in Italy was both a courageous and a naive one. Hitler and Mussolini had already been allied for the better part of a year. 8 months earlier, they had signed the Rome-Berlin Axis, a pact committing them to the same foreign policy fated to decimate so much of Europe. In August, a month before she boarded the train bound for Italia, following the Nazis' sinister lead, the Italian fascists banned Jews from receiving university degrees. But what art history student born in safe, complacent America could resist the romantic allure of Michelangelo, of Da Vinci, or Botticelli? In Siena, she notes that, quote, bold black letters on the building scream the fascist message, unquote. But her photographs of Italy evoke peace and beauty. A man rests on a jacket near the Florence Palazzo. A woman kneels in a basket and she washes clothes in a creek. A small girl, her blonde hair catching the afternoon light, holds a doll. And Annabelle notes the poetry in the landscape. Quote, palm tree amid streets in the border town of Ventimiglia, a monastery in Assisi, are bathed in the rosy light of sunset, unquote. Annabelle's imagination, like those of most artists, is visual. Even at her most articulate, her words could never render the lucidity that radiates from her artwork. And now I, using the tools of my art, the sense and sounds of words, reconstruct her life for her, illuminating her darkening memory with the images that surely were there all along. Here's an italic section. Annabelle is sitting upright in a compartment, chugging along the tracks to Florence. Her borrowed alligator suitcase sits on the shelf above her seat, squared so that it will take up as little room as possible. She is prim in her skirt and white blouse, her hair tied back, but her expression is anything but prim. Her head is tilted to the glass, and if she wanted to waste time to examine her reflection, she would note that it is full of wonder. As she takes in the sweep of the Italian countryside, the browning fall fields and the foothills of the Apennines, each rotation of the wheel, each clack on the tracks is bringing her closer to the paintings and the palazzos, the marble and the mosaics from the art books she has dog-eared in her dedication to return to their images again and again. As the whistle blows after a stop, Annabelle is startled when the compartment door opens and in strides a figure in a black fascist uniform. One who casts such a great shadow over the entire compartment that it seems suddenly dark. She shivers, scoots closer to the window, feels the chill on the glass of the early fall air. He towers over her, shoves his suitcase on the shelf, making a noise as it thuds into the wall and knocking hers just a tad to the right. "Scusi," he says. She is surprised at his kindness and, without thinking, lifts her head up and up. Her gaze catches on his fine pressed trousers, his shirt, and all that black. He takes the seat next to her. It is the only one left. She keeps her arms at her sides. "Buongiorno," he says, his voice resonating from his wide ribcage, and smiles. He smiles. Smiles. He asks where she is going, and afraid not to respond, she tells him haltingly, partly because the few words of Italian she can offer are mostly from the world of music and painting and cathedrals, or from ordering from dinner menus. And all the while she is mouthing the words, "for I'm fine, thank you, and yes, the countryside is pretty today," she is eyeing his black shirt, his tasseled cap, imagining the Manganiello in his leather grip, wondering if he would have spoken to her if he had known. She spends the next 5 hours straining to communicate, hoping he cannot hear her accelerated pulse. I have tried to make this scene more Annie's than mine, but I know only that she sat with a fascist soldier in a train and that she felt fear. I also know that she was surprised by his kindness. History professor in college was a learned man who wore impeccable suits and called us Miss if he called us anything at all. We sat in the dark and watched his slightly hunched shadow flicker over the gargantuan projections of his slides of cathedral apses and transepts, of still lives of apples and flasks. He once showed us a ceramic orangey urn from the Minoan period, painted with the tar-colored image of a man somersaulting over the horns of a charging bull. I recognized this design from a book about frescoes that had referred to the ritual of bull leaping in ancient Greece, and my eyes widened in recognition, as if this aloof professor and I were connected by some secret. The next slide showed the same orangey vase, but instead of a tar-colored image of a bull and gymnast, the only black image on the urn consisted of 3 or 4 disjointed triangles. They looked like a sampling of puzzle pieces that would be a large and mysterious design. The professor explained that this was the actual piece of pottery found in the dig, and that the bull rider picture had been reconstructed, the result of research and restoration. This image flickers often inside my brain when I think of memory, how we fill in the blanks with our own yearnings. And I long to fill in the blanks that my aunt has lent me. I say lent me because no matter how much I long to take it and shape it and eternalize it in the way of ancient Greeks who left us the legacy of their shimmering mix of religion and art, I can never own this story, but perhaps I can restore it. Italics. It is 1980. Annabel has spent the last 3 decades going about the business of creating her life, a life similar to those that thousands of other first-generation scions of immigrants were creating across America. She had reared 2 boys, planned their bar mitzvahs, helped them with their homework, kept their home kosher, cooked brisket on the Sabbath, lit Shabbat candles every week, paid their East Coast college tuitions, visited her family regularly, donated money to people in need anonymously, as is the Talmudic tradition, fulfilling the destiny she in part chose when she returned to America in 1937 and assured herself the extraordinary gift of an ordinary life. However, she also has taken courses in painting and sculpture, and now she wants to learn photography. After all, her boys have grown up and will someday soon, she hopes, give her and Sammy grandchildren. She will want to take beautiful pictures of them. But there is something else, too. She wants to create art. She wants to produce photographs that gleam and invite, intrigue and stun, evoke and provoke. It is her turn to talk with the professor now. She has just come out of the dark room next to the classroom, and she imagines she sees a slight frown. She wants so much to get that light right. "It'll come," he reassures her. His name is Hans Levy, a Jewish name. She no longer has to worry about people thinking she is Jewish. In fact, she wants people to know. St. Louis has an active Jewish community now, and many professors are now Jewish. Washington University classrooms are half empty on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Professor Levy is looking over his shoulder. "You almost have it here," he says. His face is kindly. I imagine him with a beard, perhaps smoking a pipe after class. "Your work shows promise, talent." He is about to turn to the next student when Annie blurts out, wondering even as she mouths the syllables why she has never said these words before, "I have some negatives in my attic." He stares at her, his lips already curling up. "They're of a trip to Europe I took several years ago," she says. He leans toward her almost imperceptibly. "In 1937, she adds, and his face floods with light. "Well, let's get them out and have a look," he says, using the word "let's," as if her pictures have already begun to connect Annabelle with all the other artists whom she had dreamed about studying. She climbs the stairs to the attic of her Washington Street house near the university that had enabled her to earn a scholarship so many years before. It is now 35 years after the fall of the Third Reich, when people like her had to hide in attics like the one she's rummaging around in now. She blows dust off the boxes, peeks in a trunk, upends a stack of papers, and then she spots it, the suitcase. An overnight case, really, one she never uses, one that has moved with her three times and been in this attic for over 20 years. She is so excited she hardly dares to smile, but her eyes widen. She unzips the suitcase, touches with a finger the small canisters, the little cassettes of film, spots the strip of miniature negatives from her journey 43 years before, the strip that she had just enough money to produce after she arrived safely home. She cradles each canister one by one. The film inside is so tightly rolled that she has to soak it in water for 3 days in order to get it to lie flat. The symbolism for this resurrection is not lost on me. I wonder if it is on her. It isn't until 1985 that Annabelle enlarges and finishes the photos as a series, then collects and presents them to the public. Her debut exhibit in a sunny gallery run by Nevertheless Press on Jackson Street, not far from her house, is for her yet another dream. The photos do indeed gleam and invite, intrigue and stun, evoke and provoke. Her text is earnest, enthusiastic, and she herself is as radiant as her shot of the light on the Seine. But as much of this exhibit in some ways defines my aunt, it is impossible not to see in my memory both exhibits at once. The one of Annabelle gracefully gliding amid her walls of treasures, garnering praise, and the one of the doomed artists of Montparnasse, the ghosts. As decades and cultures collide and produce a chaotic racket inside my head, I consider what would have happened if my aunt's family had immigrated to Paris instead of St. Louis, if she had been born a few years earlier and come to the City of Light seeking the alluring artist's life in Montparnasse, if instead of studying art history, she had picked up a paintbrush and captured the gilt insignia on the Dome Cafe or the reddening of the Virginia creeper on the Atelier in a pebble-studded alley. But I don't have to wonder at all. I know. 2005, in the heart of the City of Lights, memorial to the martyrs of World War II, deportation stretches into darkness underground. Today, and for all we know most days, it is hauntingly empty. Gary and I descend a shoulder-wide precipitous stairway and tunnel into silence. At the bottom, black metal spikes and iron bars block a single opening. On the other side, we can see, but barely, the Seine illuminated with light, as it is in one of Annabelle's photos, and dotted with colorful boats and fishermen. We enter the memorial through a dark tunnel studded with shards of glass. The crypt is lit only by pale lights set into the ground. I shiver. A halo of light, stones from all the mountain ranges in France, triangular recesses in the wall holding urns, holding earth and ashes from concentration camp. A star of remembrance, symbol upon symbol, confronts us. But in spite of the stark concrete and the shadows surrounding me, another spectrum of symbols materializes before my eyes, an image from a more recent past. I see Aunt Annie at her Passover Seder, the yearly celebration of Jewish liberation from slavery by the ancient Egyptians. Her Lennox china and crystal gleaming, the symbolic foods prepared for ceremony, the haroset, apples and nuts and sugar calling to mind the sweetness of freedom, the marar, the horseradish reminding us of the bitterness of what humanity sacrificed to gain this freedom. In the Jewish tradition, she lets Sammy lead all the guests in spilling, drop by drop, with a spoon, the Mogen David wine on their plates. One drop for every death camp. Italics. As Annabelle leaves Europe, she is wistful. The ship noses out of the harbor and heads toward Lady Liberty. Annie's hands that will become those of an artist, rest on the railing as she gazes back to the shore. Perhaps she is memorizing the colors of the coast, the shapes of the clouds, and in the distance the graceful forms of the basin and the docks, so that she can paint them someday, so that she can somehow offer to another generation her experience as a legacy. Perhaps somewhere in her psyche she suspects that Europe will never be the same, that in a handful of years this land will be pitted by bombs, torpedoed and torn and littered with human limbs, awash in blood. For now she is sad to leave this artist's paradise across the sea, sad to leave the land of Cézanne and Chagall and Chaim Soutine, of Matisse and Max Jacob, though she doesn't know that Soutine will soon die trying to avoid arrest, or that Jacob will soon die at Drancy. And she doesn't know that the ship that is carrying her home to safety through the lapping waves of the Atlantic, the 1927 flagship of the proud Holland-America line, will, 2.5 years later, be incinerated in a bombing raid. For now, she is taking with her what she brought, the fortuitous mix of courage and innocence that will deliver her safely home. Her life is lit with luck. 2006. This is the light I see in her eyes as Annabelle angles her head toward the camera in 1937. She is seated in a sidewalk cafe in a curved back rattan chair. The perspective leads the viewer's eye back toward the floral ironwork and then to the illuminated street, the French pedestrians going about their business months before their weak-kneed Third Republic collapses. In the foreground, two round tables have been brought together so that five compatriots and she can have a glass of wine or beer, or perhaps a Coke. There are a bottle and tall empty glasses on the table. Two of the companions are occupied with picking up something that has dropped to the ground. Annabelle is the only Jewish person at the table, perhaps the only Jewish person on the street. Her face in profile is the center point of the composition. Her body is pictured in profile, her left arm draped into her lap, hand resting on thigh. She is wearing a striped shirt with a bow at the collar, her legs crossed at the knee under her skirt, her dark hair primly back from her forehead and bound at the back of her neck. She is turning to the camera as the man in the white starched collar leans on his wrist, his elbow on the table, his expression forming an unwavering line to hers. If I were an art historian, I would conjecture that the photographer is positing a story between them, a secret in common, an impossible love, a political alliance. As a writer, I am longing for that story. But what happened is buried in the vicissitudes of memory, and I can resurrect only what I see. At my daughter's wedding, Annie and I embrace, then weep. Her body is frail, but her arms are tight around me. Her journey at 93 from St. Louis to New York City shines with the same dedication she exhibited when she boarded that ship nearly 70 years before, when she transcended the domain of the ordinary to paint and sculpt, when she unwound and flattened those rolls of film. But there's something more in our tight embrace. I sense the luminous and enduring presence of the artist's need to witness. As the secret Jewish artist witnessed the horror of Dachau, as the young Jewish woman in St. Louis braved the first stirrings of the Holocaust to witness the beauty of art, as a woman in Idaho, more than a generation later, awakened to the need to witness a past already muddled in the mysteries of memory and proffer her testimony. Annabelle's face in the photograph is looking toward the future, past the chaos of destruction that will gather momentum in the coming handful of years, and towards, decades later, toward the bride and groom, toward me. Thank you.
Joy Passanante. Her essay is called Annabelle Before the War, Only What I See. I first aired this story on Yin Radio on March 22, 2007, shortly after Joy's reading. The essay has since been published in the Georgia Review and was awarded a 2008 Gamma Award for Best Profile from the Magazine Association of the Southeast. Thanks for joining me for this Yin Radio show, Annabelle's Story. You can listen to past shows or podcast this show, or you can sign up for our electronic newsletter at yinradio.org. You can drop us a line at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's yinradio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho. I am Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. Music is by Piano Chocolat. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation. Thanks for joining me. Until next week.